Radio.
Mercy and the New Evangelization, a talk by Anna Crone. This talk is part of the Jubilee Year of Mercy series entitled Mercy, Love's Second Name, presented by the John Paul II Institute for Marriage and Family in Melbourne, Australia.
Thanks very much. It's wonderful to be in this wonderful parish. And thank you, Father Dillon, for initiating such a wonderful start to the Jubilee Year of Mercy. Pope Francis writes in his bull, in diction for the year of the Jubilee Year, "Jesus Christ is the face of the Father's mercy." These words might well sum up the mystery of the Christian faith. Now, this bull both announces and proclaims a year of grace. In other words, in a way, the Pope is invoking the Holy Spirit to inspire what he writes about, to become present in the Church. In paragraph 10 of the document Misericordiae Vultus, the face of mercy, he says, "Mercy is the very foundation of the Church's life. In all her pastoral activity, it should be caught up in the tenderness she makes present to believers. Nothing in her preaching and in her witness to the world can be lacking in mercy." Now, in this little tiny paragraph 10, Pope Francis is evoking a foundational encyclical which Pope St. John Paul II, wrote very early in his pontificate, Rich in Mercy. And in it, the Pope captures two aspects of mercy, what you might call the ethical commitment of mercy, the acts of mercy, the reality of mercy in that sense, but also mercy as an attitude, as a tenderness, as something that is experienced in the attitude of the one who gives mercy and the one who receives it. Now, I think this idea of the two aspects of mercy is actually begun, this discussion is begun by John Paul II, carried on by Pope Benedict, and brought together in this simple little paragraph by Pope Francis. But I think it's what I'd like to look at today, how these two aspects of mercy are important in the new evangelization. In this, also, Pope Francis is echoing the scriptures. And it's a call for the Church to review, and all baptized, of course, to review what they understand about taking the gospel out into the world, its missionary reality. We're all missionaries. Today's reading in the gospel really evokes Christ's missionary work, doesn't it? He says, "I didn't come because I chose to. I came because I was sent." And in baptism, we are sent with him. At the end of Mass, we are sent. We encounter the mercy of God in the Blessed Sacrament, in the sacrifice of the Mass. But we don't just go home and put on the roast chook. Well, we do, but we do it with a different sense of our vocations. In his earlier encyclical, Pope Francis, Evangelii Gaudium, writes, "It is the first task of the Church that missionary outreach is paradigmatic for all the Church's activity." Paradigmatic. So we are missionaries just by nature of being Christians. And Pope Francis also insists that this missionary task is not primarily to the comfortable or the domestic, although we don't leave the domestic out, but as is the preference of the Church, to the poor. This option for the poor, he says, and here he cites Pope Benedict XVI, was taught, as Pope Benedict himself has said, is implicit in our Christian faith, in a God who became poor for us, so as to enrich us in our poverty. Who is the poor? All humanity. Each human being. Us, in fact. And part of this missionary activity is to allow Christ to be sent to us, to remake us, so that we can be resent. And that's the challenging call of new evangelization. Pope Francis asked this troubling question of two things. Firstly, of the Church. Have we really, in the end, forgotten how to live mercy? And secondly, have we failed to lead in mercy in a world where such realities as militaristic fundamentalism, on the one hand, and hard-bitten, self-seeking secularism, on the other, think about those two extremes, both have no place for mercy? He says, the word and the concept mercy seems to cause uneasiness in man, who, thanks to the enormous development of science and technology, never before known in history, has become the master of the earth and subdued and dominated it. This dominion over the earth, sometimes understood in a one-sided and superficial way, seems to have no room for mercy. The problem is not that we do not understand, simply that we don't understand mercy, but that we do not acknowledge creation, or the Creator, or the Redeemer. And to take it even further, we do not even understand what things are anymore. Ideas become sound bites, and the real thing is a soft drink. So it's a metaphysical problem that underlies our rejection of mercy.
Just want to put another slide up there.
Francis talks about the waning of mercy as one of the challenges for taking the gospel out into the world. Let's have a look at that. He writes again, I dream of a missionary option, he says, which is capable of transforming everything so that the Church's way of doing things can be suitably channeled for the evangelization of today's world rather than for her self-preservation. Now, in this, Pope Francis is echoing similar words from Pope John Paul II. He says, don't just invent another program in his going out into the deep. He says, no, we don't want more programs. We don't want more building programs, even though they're good, and I know you've done them really well here. The only purpose for buildings is for the life of the Church, to share this life of Christ. If we're not doing that, then the buildings can wait, and we need to be transformed back into our baptism, as I think Connor and Owen said so beautifully. So evangelization is not merely a successful program, and it's not really just indoctrination either, nor is it even the best type of information sharing. Sometimes we can get overwhelmed by our social media and think that all we need to do is transfer information from one person to another. The apostles didn't see their missionary activity as being about transferring information. However, they did want to share and to witness to the power of the resurrection and the mercy that that brought about in their lives. They touched God's mercy in Christ. And there are many beautiful scriptural references to talk about the immediacy of their experience of mercy, and that they had to share it. They had to go out. Pope John Paul II, in his Crossing the Threshold of Hope, is asked about new evangelization. He says, it's the entire wide-ranging commitment to reflect upon revealed truth. The entire wide-ranging commitment to reflect upon revealed truth. Now, that doesn't sound like rushing about madly, does it? It starts with this contemplative listening and watching of the truth revealed in the scriptures, encountered in the sacraments, met in prayer. In other words, if we could put it simply, shut up and listen before you think you're a missionary. And it's a very important point that John Paul reflects on in his discussion of evangelization. And also, Pope Francis says, you have to see the face of Christ before you can take the face of Christ. You have to encounter that. So we first of all have to be the meeting place of those revealed truths, the person of Christ, the truth of the gospel. So the very definition of the Church as missionary is to be the place that witnesses to what happens to us, first of all, in being made by the loving Father, secondly, by being saved in the Son, and thirdly, being sanctified and animated by the Holy Spirit. The church and Christians and the baptized need to allow that to happen to them first, and in an ongoing way. You don't simply stop and say, well, now I've encountered the revealed truth, so I'll pack up and I'll continue on my missionary way. That has been a problem, hasn't it? The church and all Christians are therefore not just static, standing in their place in the world. In fact, they are, says the Pope, statu missionis, in a state of mission, of going out of their own egos, of their bricks and mortar, of the safety of their own homes, as the great missionaries of the 19th century did, but of the great missionaries that we are now doing. We either go out culturally, go out to our workplaces, go out through our families, go out to the parent-teacher meetings, whatever we're doing, by being attentive to the revealed truth, by being receptive of the grace of the sacraments, we become missionary. Because those realities of the church are filled with God's love, which desires to find the poor. We take revealed truth into ourselves, into our lives, and into our attitudes, our actions, and our words, and we are changed. If we are not transformed by these, then as St. Paul says, I'm simply taking out my own message. And it's not easy to be a missionary, as Pope John Paul says in Crossing the Threshold of Hope. There is a powerful anti-evangelization also taking place in, you might call it, the culture of death in other places, which is well organized and has the means to vigorously oppose the gospel and evangelization. It is opposing mercy, Christian mercy. And this is why we have to be aware that we need to be constantly renewed in the way that we evangelize. The new evangelization means constantly taking into account how this anti-evangelization might be working in the world, how we might be influenced by anti-evangelization, how we may have become blinded by forces within ourselves. In the year 2000, the then Cardinal Ratzinger said in his address to catechists, we can see a progressive process of de-Christianization and a loss of essential human values, which is worrisome. It's kind of an understatement, but it's worrisome. A large part of today's humanity does not find the gospel in the usual evangelization of the church. And that asks a very interesting question. Why are we not getting that? What's the encounter that's not happening there? In this, Pope Benedict asked for a new evangelization, and in this he's reflecting the words of Pope Paul VI, who in his document, Evangelii Nuntiandi, which is the place where new evangelization was first synthesized as a term, even though there was many people adapting the gospel, taking the gospel out and challenging different aspects of their culture, as we've seen. Paul VI said, we need to take into account the new language, the new technology, the rapidity in which technology moves us through the world, dislocation, in order to know how to communicate the stories of the gospel, but also how to be the face of mercy, which is the core of the gospel. We are always tempted, and even the baptized are tempted, to move away from the gospel. We are tempted in our attitudes, in our commitments, in our words, in our hearts, to cut the corners, to soften the blow, to become static, to grow dull, secularized, unconverted ourselves, to become only superficially Christian. And sometimes the culture or ethos of our own parish or our own family has become smug or complacent, as I say, unconverted, no longer really encountering the face of Christ as God's mercy. Perhaps because we feel that we are essentially good people, That's one I love when people say, I don't need to go to church because essentially I'm a good person. They might be quite good, but we're not called just to be good, we're called to be holy, to be made new by holiness. So there's a newness in that phrase of new evangelization that means constantly encountering the saving grace of Jesus Christ, constantly being converted to that. Never tiring of being converted. Every Lent is an experience of conversion. There are also factors which Pope John Paul identified that make it hard for us to get to the gist of the reality of mercy. And in order to look a little bit more closely at that, John Paul, in his document of 1980, Dives et Misericordias, which is, I think, echoed in Francis' book and in his writing about mercy, we discover some interesting discussion. For one thing, we become aware as we read the great Pope's words that the secular West, the idea of naming has been reduced to a marketing tool. Naming something. What's in the name? Not much. So we take a name as an evocation of fashion, perhaps. Names, the use of names are studied in focus groups. Have you ever been part of that? How does that word sound? And I know as we go home to Ballarat, there are many suburbs that are called names that are simply lies. Water view in a dried up old field. That because in the study group that word brought about nice feelings in people's imaginations. But there's absolutely no bearing on place at all. Or sometimes names are cynically deployed in order to provoke a predictable response in customers or interest groups. So odd has this process of distorting names in the world of virtual reality and branding that it's now possible to change the label of our job descriptions. We are no longer waiters, but lifestyle consultants. No longer garbage men, but sanitation officers. And even recently, we've seen the rise of the naming of realities about our own bodies and our sexual realities, which are given sticky labels with a whole bewildering galaxy of different titles, which in somehow try to convey our subjective sense of our sexual or interpersonal reality. We call these genders, and I think at last count the UN has recognised 57 words are things we impose on reality. Now, we always know human beings cooperate in naming. That's one of the great things that God the Creator gave as a power to Adam. But the power of naming was the naming of his creation. We were given the great privilege of naming his creation as stewards. Now we have a completely nominalistic sense of reality, that if I call it something, it is. Giving ourselves, or trying to take to ourselves, the power of the Creator. In other words, God names things and they become fact, they become reality. But we are trying to do the same thing. However, in our Catholic tradition and in Catholic theology and in the scriptures, names remain important. They are God-given and they are rich in power, reality and meaning. Names and the use of logos connects us to God who created all things. Pope John Paul II reminds us of this power of naming in his discussion of mercy. He presses the point that the Church only can use the word mercy because of the saving work of Christ the Redeemer. In other words, the name of mercy is God's love when he looks upon and touches humanity. That is mercy. That is that reality, not some other reality. That is mercy. Later, he explores the importance of that naming again. And towards the end of his pontificate, he reminds us that mercy is revealed in the very name of Jesus, Yeshua. God saves. God saves means, he says, to liberate us from radical evil. That's God's mercy. God's mercy goes to the limits of evil to bring us back. It liberates us from radical evil, from which we cannot liberate ourselves. But Jesus not only liberates us from evil, he liberates us for the good, ultimately to be one with his Father, to be part of the life of the Blessed Trinity. Namely, he calls us for union with God, who is the source of our happiness and our fullness of life. In other words, we are not who we really should be unless we are saved. We are only half ourselves, half undeveloped, half unreal, captured by sin. So mercy, in this sense, very powerfully, is not just a soothing touch, something, but a soothing touch which is soothing because it takes us and liberates us from our prison or from our blindness or from some other evil, whether that's moral, spiritual or physical. John Paul II says, this is what mercy means, saving us. Christian soteriology, he says, is a soteriology of the fullness of life. Not only is it a soteriology of truth disclosed in revelation, so it's not just about a fact of revelation, but it's a soteriology of saving because we meet God's love, God's divine love. Now, that's a very loaded word. I think Owen used the word last week. Here's a loaded definition of mercy. It's a full definition of mercy, which includes elements that we sometimes get a little bit confused about: pity, sympathy, compassion. Each one of these has a particular powerful and attractive force to it. The term pity, in St. Thomas's writing, St. Thomas Aquinas, means to suffer on account of the evil done to another. So I suffer because I see somebody else suffering in an unwarranted way, undeserved, sometimes. So that's Aristotle's understanding of pity. Someone who looks down on someone suffering undeservedly. But Aristotle's pity didn't extend to people who were too far beneath him. He didn't really pity a slave. He might, but it's not that mercy that extends to the extents of deprivation and evil at all. Compassion is also related to this term. Compassion means suffering with somebody, feeling with somebody. So having compassion can also mean taking joy with them on something that's good. And obviously, Jesus Christ himself had compassion. That word's used many times. He felt with, without ever becoming, almost to the point of experiencing sin in the letter to the Hebrews, when it says he became sin for us. He suffered the evil that sin imposes on us without ever participating in sin. It's an extreme form of mercy. For this type of mercy, which embraces a number of those phrases, to save means, says John Paul, to embrace and lift up with redemptive love, a love that is always greater than sin, to lift the person up. And the image of the Good Samaritan and the prodigal son here comes very powerfully to mind. It's a very dynamic sense. It's not just me feeling it and going home. It's me acting in some way to lift that person out of their suffering or their evil. And God's mercy does that to us. Now, one of the things that I think is interesting in this waning of, I don't know whether you can see this, but one of the factors in our society that can confuse us about the ethos of mercy is because many of our contemporary philosophies and ideologies reject mercy or they distort mercy. So, for instance, this is lovely Friedrich Nietzsche here saying, I do not like the merciful, but all those who create are strong. I don't like the merciful. It's a pathetic feeling. Pity is pitiable. It's only for the weak. So that's, Nietzsche is probably the most influential philosopher in our very sort of hard-bitten competitive world. And we see this competitive edge, which doesn't allow mercy, emerging in a number of places. For instance, have you noticed any time something appears in the paper You have persecution by newspaper. We've seen a great example of that over the last week. Is there any mercy shown? Once you've picked a side, you have no mercy for the other side. And you start to rally around and say, all things are legal if I can attack someone identified as evil. I call it posse justice. In other words, I'm not going to wait for the rule of law. I'm going to get a band of my men, go out on the sword and go out on the horse and hang someone, as you see in those old westerns, posse justice. In other words, denial of the rule of law, making yourself the sheriff of the town and getting a gang of men with rifles and exacting your own justice. We're starting to see that, which in a sense is a sign of the crumbling of our civilization in many real ways, without being too alarmist about it. But, you know, the rule of law is in some ways a preservation of justice, at least a process for justice, even if in the end you can't bring back somebody who's been killed by an evil person. You can protect the rule of justice. There's also an element in this misunderstanding of mercy that is neo-Darwinian. In other words, only the strong survive. So why revive somebody? Why revive a baby that's born with a disability? Only the strong have a right to survive. We should be able to choose the strongest and forget about the weakest, because we will weaken ourselves by being close to the sick or the ill. That's actually Nietzsche's idea. Don't get too close to the sick. It's infectious. Weakness is infectious. And mercy and pity, as he saw it in the Christian example, or the witness that he saw it as simply as a weakness. And then there is hyper-consumerism that says, well, mercy is very just about me. It's about what I say mercy is. So you've got to like me, and if you say anything critical of me, you're actually being discriminatory and unmerciful. These are all distortions of the Christian reality of mercy. Mercy is about giving fullness of life, rescuing from evil, not ignoring evil, rescuing from evil, lifting a person up. Not leaving them to suffer either the moral, spiritual, physical, or any other type of aspect of the evil. And often the moral evil is the most serious and most suffering-inducing pain that you can have. And I think there's one other sense in which mercy is completely misunderstood, and this is going to keep coming up in our parliament. It is that when human beings dispense with God and God's ownership of life, then we believe that we can dispense mercy ourselves. And mercy killing is an example of mercy without any reference to God as the Lord of life. And we see the calamitous sliding slope of that in countries like the Netherlands, where you just keep reinterpreting who should receive your boundless mercy. There's no end to your boundless humanistic mercy. So that now in Holland, it's considered merciful to end the lives of those who are depressed or to end the lives of babies who are not quite right. And you can apply yourself, if you think you're chronically depressed, to receive the boundless mercy, if you like, the boundless extension of the culture of life, of which Pope John, the culture of death, which is the face of mercy in the case of mercy killing. The only kind of mercy is death. So, a great distortion of John Paul II's discussion of mercy. However, believing in God's mercy is not a denial of the reality, of the horror of evil. It's sometimes some of these modern humanistic philosophers say, oh, you just tolerated evil under the name of mercy. And we can see in the scandal of the child abuse issue in the church, cases where responsibility was not taken and perhaps fear displaced mercy. In other words, I'm too afraid to look at this problem, I can't handle it, we'll just move it along. That's not mercy. That's irresponsibility. And sadly, that scandalizes our society about the reality of mercy. It looks like a weak option. It looks like allowing evil or accepting evil. And the same could be said of those Christians who, for instance, tolerated the horrors of the Nazi regime. Whereas we said, well, it's better than the other option, so we'll go with this. You can see the temptation, can't you, to say, well, we'll be understanding about this type of thing. But a person who reminds us, I think, that mercy is about telling and meeting the truth is the great Catholic author G.K. Chesterton. He says, it's interesting that that one of the works, and he's echoing here John Paul II, one of the works of mercy is to convince the world of sin. And reflecting here, John 16:3, to convince the world of sin, which is not the same as condemning the world. To save means to lift up and embrace with redemptive love. He goes on in Orthodoxy, in the sort of humanistic, deterministic stance, there is no place for the pure horror of injustice, such as that which is a great beauty in the innocent. It is the justice position that leaves no place for a mere tenderness for men as men, such as is the whole fascination of the charitable. Christianity came in here as before. It came in startlingly with a sword and clove one thing from another. It divided the crime from the criminal. The criminal we must forgive unto 70 times 7, but the crime we must not forgive at all. We must be much more angry with the theft than before, and yet much kinder to thieves than before. It's a fascinating quotation, isn't it, Gay? Which I think captures well what I think our position on mercy is. Mercy is not about tolerating evil. However, it is about reaching out and embracing those caught up in evil, and that's the real challenge. We hear this echoed in the words of the Psalms, and these also echo in the ethical personalism of John Paul II and Pope Benedict. Pope Francis echoes Pope Benedict very directly when he says, "The mercy of God is not an abstract idea, but a concrete reality in which he reveals his love to us as that of a father or a mother moved to the very depths out of love for their child. It's hardly an exaggeration to say that his is a visceral love." Hesed love, I think maybe Owen went through those two types of love, the love that a mother feels by carrying the baby in her womb, that sort of strong reaction, only metaphorical, of course, but real when we look at the cross. The church was born out of this visceral love, this mercy, out of the love on the cross. It gushes forth, says Francis, from the depths, full of tenderness and compassion and mercy, indulgence and mercy. God's word is a merciful word and therefore concrete, truth-telling, but also personal. It is very far from abstraction or remoteness. His word in Jesus Christ is the good news, not simply because it makes us feel good for a moment, because it actually changes us, and in taking that to someone's experiencing evil, they feel lifted up. And in some small way, redeemed. It's not us doing it, but it's us, in a sense, reaching out and being the hands of mercy. As Connor Sweeney said so beautifully 2 weeks ago, God's words of mercy are himself made flesh. The mystery, he says, literally jumps out of the pages of the sacred text as spoken words, as gestures, as acts, and from here, as lived and experienced reality, enters into my heart, into my body, and into my mind. Mercy comes from the heart of Jesus Christ and is the love that has hands through the charity of the Church, which itself comes from the God's rushing out, his missionary love, which desires to reach out to us. And as Owen said last week, mercy flows from the very heart of Jesus Christ and is how he relates to us. And the sacraments, then, are personal and tangible expressions. They are the gifts of Christ's mercy. So we live in a world, in the Church, that is constantly calling us to this missionary mercy love. Mercy is sometimes described as one of the Beatitudes, and we haven't got time to talk about the Beatitudes. But Monsignor Livio Molina, who is the president of the John Paul II Institute in Rome, has a beautiful way of talking about the Beatitudes. He says, It's not just another task for Christians to do, but it's the way we become part of the self-portrait of Christ himself. When Christ teaches us the Beatitudes, he's telling us about how he loves. So patience, poverty of spirit, purity, all those qualities are not simply natural virtues. They are Christ's own dispositions to us. And we are invited as baptized people, as Conrad and Owen have both invited us, to be part, to make up the face of Jesus in the world, to be part, little tile perhaps, in the face of Jesus. And there's many ways that we can see that, but we're asked to be two things. I'm going to propose now for the rest of this, is first of all, a parable of mercy, and secondly, an icon of mercy. So a story about mercy, this particular type of story that Jesus told, the parables, reveals so much about mercy. So the Good Samaritan, people often think that these are true stories, but these are stories that Jesus tells in order to show us how God is, how the kingdom is. They're only just a little glimpse of a much greater reality. So in that respect, they're almost they are sacramental, aren't they? They just touch in a little way on a truth that Jesus is trying to convey. And we know that at times the apostles are completely mystified about this. But it's interesting that mercy is revealed so beautifully through the parables, because we can't fathom the bottomless mercy of God. And a parable is parabolic. It comes close and then moves away. For anyone who's good at maths, we know what a parabola is. You can't fathom the mercy of God. But you travel towards it in a parable. It takes you into the story. It's a very imaginative, powerful way of conveying God's mercy. And St. Luke himself is a great master of conveying this story. Remember, it's St. Luke who says, talks of the love of the Father of mercies in chapter 15 of St. Luke. God creates us in what I think Connor has called our original mercy. He created us out of mercy, out of this boundless love, this generous, extravagant love. This original mercy, he gave us a share in his own image and likeness, in his own love. So therefore, we have this iconic, we are a story of God's. In a sense, we're called to be a story of God, each in our own individual ways. He shapes us in his merciful love. But we need to understand that we are also fallen, that we are constantly tempted away from this parable and from this imaging. So the story of the prodigal son, very powerful, isn't it? But one, and the Good Samaritan also. But perhaps the story that reveals one aspect of the mercy that we sometimes don't think of, and that is the joy of mercy, something that ties together two themes that Pope Francis speaks of. Mercy is a dramatic, life-changing event. To encounter mercy, to feel mercy, to know it, is to change your life. All things were over, and mercy is a newness, a freshness, a going back to Eden. There's a great little story that Father Corrigan told, again quoting Chesterton, that to encounter the mercy of God in the confession is to be an old man who goes into confession and to come out as an eight-day-old baby, to go back to Eden in a way that's very powerful. Do you have that experience? You think, oh, it's really hard. Does anyone find it hard to go to confession here? Anyone love it?
Yeah.
You love it, good for you. You must be very converted, is all I can say. But, you know, there's often a horrible bundle of anxiety as you're waiting to go to confession or to think of, this, and is that really the same? And it's why you need to have plenty of time to reflect on this. But it's a standing in judgment of yourself that if you don't like being wrong, which most of us don't, it's quite challenging, even before you get in to the actual sacrament. So it's a pilgrimage. You're going to this encounter weighed down, aged, blinded, crippled by all the anxieties, over the anxieties of the thing that you did wrong or maybe did wrong. And as Chesterton, I think, captures so beautifully, You walk out as an 8-day-old baby. It's just, you know, when you've made a good confession, it's an extraordinary reality. Even if you don't feel it, what's happened is very much like the celebration of the father and the prodigal son. I remember my grandmother telling me the story of the prodigal son and saying, when you go to confession, all the angels are cheering and having a... And I was sort of in our funny little church in the pew. I used to think, I wonder where they are. I wonder if they can see that I've been in confession. But it captures a great reality about the newness and the freshness and the joy of encountering God's mercy. Mercy is a dramatic and life-changing event. Mercy also comes from the great sacrifice of Christ's blood. Dietrich von Hilbert, in a page that's missing from my printout, I was going to show, that he says, when we are touched by mercy, we are saved and re-blooded, given new blood, by the blood of Christ on the cross. His mercy, in a sense, reanimates us from the cross. And that is a cause for almost a sort of immediate resurrection of ourselves. It's an interesting theology of the cross, this idea that Christ's mercy reaches so far to us in his sacrificing of his life to the Father, that his blood saves us by reanimating us, giving us, making us the 8-day-old baby that Chesterton writes about. And all of this is so very different from the counterfeits of mercy, or counterfeits or quasi-counterfeits of mercy that may have changed people's understanding of what mercy really is. So, for instance, high-handed pity, I pity you, is not mercy, but something rightly that people reject. I don't want your pity. Now, John Paul says that mercy does another thing. It restores our dignity from creation. So there's no reason for us to stand above somebody pitying them, because all we're doing is embracing them and lifting them to where we want to be, which is the original dignity of who God wants us to be. There's nothing superior about that at all. And it also involves us saying, suspending our judgment sometimes, not of what's right and wrong, but of the moral state of the person that we're working with. We don't know necessarily the intricacies of a person's moral life, their freedom, what's in their mind or heart, or how mentally well or unwell they are. It's not our business in a sense to form that judgment. We're only there to say, this is an evil, I need to help this person for this. And that's where I think some of the new evangelization is very helpful. It shows us ways to, first of all, concentrate on our own contemplation of mercy in our lives, and secondly, to allow that mercy to make us forget that we in any way can offer mercy to others without God, without God in our lives. It's only through the power of Christ that we can give mercy in any shred of a way that stops you feeling in any way superior to anybody. However, and it also means that it's a hard reality in some ways, even though it's a joyful reality. It's one that constantly asks us to leave ourselves behind, to leave our egos. And it's much more than calling, for instance, for a sorry day or to wear black armbands. All of those things are helpful, but I think, what do you call it, own text messaging kind of sympathy is perhaps what Pope Benedict would call cheap grace. Doesn't take you very long, doesn't mean very much, it makes you feel okay, but we're not actually transformed by it. There's the term for mercy, chesed, that's the Hebrew, chesed, loving kindness, but also fidelity. So it's not wrong to feel, to transform our lives so that we now feel that we want to help people from a particular evil. This is where von Hildebrand is very helpful. He says, our feelings about objective reality are a good thing. It's good to foster the sense of the value of beauty. What I think people rejected in the past as cold as charity, the kind of superiority that says, well, I'll give you some help, but you have to be a deserving poor. A cold, hard-hearted sense of mercy, which is not God's mercy. When in doubt, think about the cross.
And here's an image of the mercy of the church, which is maternal.
It's a beautiful image of the church as the mother of mercy, modelling her own mother in Our Lady at the cross. There's nothing unfeeling. So don't be afraid that somehow you have to be grit your teeth and be merciful. And I think there is sometimes a danger for us to think that we either have to be a martyr to mercy. It's tempting, isn't it? I do so much to help others. You've forgotten to see the dignity of the person who needs to be lifted up. You're ticking off successful, merciful things that you've done. Your focus is not on the person as person, this personalist idea of going out of yourself to the other person. Or secondly, you say, well, I can do mercy. You know that terrible series, Summer Hill High? Do you remember the teenage girl who's in that? Who? What's her name? Jamie? She tries... What's her name?
Jermaine.
Jermaine is this sophisticated, very superficial girl who decides that she's going to do a 40-hour famine to lose weight and then celebrates how many babies she's helping in Africa. It's all kind of... It's a terribly awful revelation of somebody who doesn't understand what mercy is. But we can be tempted to that, can't we? Feel good. And it's not wrong to feel good, but is the objective? Are we really offering mercy? Is this really a merciful thing? Is this really lifting people up from evil?
And Pope Benedict says, the mercy of Christ is not a cheap grace. It does not presume a trivialisation of evil. Christ carries in his body and on his soul the whole weight of evil and all its destructive force. He burns and transforms evil through suffering in the fire of his suffering love. Now that's mercy. It's challenging and it's difficult. So how do we become icons of mercy? I was thinking about who the icons of mercy are. And I thought, who are some of the recent icons of mercy? And there are some, and they're called the saints, or at least the holy people of the church. And it's interesting to look at how mercy operates in their lives. This one was not a saint, but her cause has been introduced. Dorothy Dare, who was a hard-nosed kind of journalist who had a very rough life, but was touched by God's mercy. She tragically was in a very destructive relationship and had an abortion, and from immediately saw the evil of that and began to say, well, part of what I must do is reach out and talk about the justice that workers need. I fear to go out and meet them. Now, she had a particularly close encounter with God's healing mercy. It was real, and every single day it was real for her. She founded what was called the Catholic Worker Movement in America, a very modern figure in lots of ways. And she says, and the quote doesn't come up, she says, the role of a Catholic is to live the corporal works of mercy every day. That's how real it was for her, so real that she tried to shape her life around living what the church traditionally calls the corporal works of mercy and the spiritual works of mercy as well. The corporal works of mercy, to feed the hungry, to give drink to the thirsty, to clothe the naked, to shelter the homeless, to visit the sick, to visit the imprisoned, to bury the dead. To love someone is to desire the person's good and to take effective steps to secure it. You don't really have to go very far to find people who need one or other variation on these simple corporal bodily needs. And the spiritual needs of works of mercy, likewise. Probably in your own home, next door, in the parish. Really, leading up to the Second Vatican Council, people were very aware of these. They really knew that this was part of their life as a Christian. This is just what you did. This is how you were the self-portrait of Christ. Now, sometimes you went in with mixed motives, but that was constantly something to purify. Another person, I think, who's even more clearly...
is Frederick Ozanam himself. He was born in 1918. Now, he was born in a large family and he came from Lyon. His father was a doctor. And anyone who's a fan of Les Miserables will get the picture of some of the problems that were occurring in Paris at that time.
Frederick was a student who was already aware of the massive population of displaced and impoverished new urban dwellers, displaced culturally by the French Revolution and displaced economically by the Industrial Revolution. And it's very interesting that Frederick saw the rise of humanistic socialism, which was anti-Catholic, also as a challenge to him as a Catholic. He said, I can see that they want to improve the lives of the urban poor. He's sympathetic with that. But he was fired by the story of the Good Samaritan, the parable of the Good Samaritan, which, and also spurred by the impression that is formed by some of those humanists around him, that all intellectual and scientific life and the promotion of liberty was opposed by a predominantly clericalist and petty bourgeois Catholic Church. In other words, he could see that the Church was not always the one to see to be the face of mercy. He criticised the socialists, said, you don't understand what mercy is. To counter this, he devoted himself on two fronts, showing that Catholics were imaginative and devoted scholars of history and literature. He translated Dante, for instance. He got a doctorate in literature. He studied law. He wrote on the role of the Church. He's an extraordinary scholar. It was also in that time of a social and ideological turbulence in France that Frederick was challenged by the rationalists and the secularists about their perceived perception that the Church was inactive and inert. Admittedly, the Church was at this stage reeling from years of persecution and the decimation of the French Revolution, so that was a factor as well. As the Archbishop of Paris recently, Archbishop Vantois, says, Frederick is the model of the new evangelization of his own time, a person who challenged the obscuring of the gospel by his own study, his dedication and energy. The Archbishop says, he trained from childhood to serve the poor. He was challenged by an opponent, and we are all familiar with the words of that angry voice, your Christianity is dead. Where are your works that demonstrate your faith and could make us respect and accept it? He took these questions as a call from God, and very quickly, with a small group of friends, he began visiting the poor. That group, what was so remarkable about Frederick was that so long before the flowering of the modern church's social teaching, he would base his mission on the incarnation of mercy, upon what the Church sees as the four pillars of its social teaching. The compendium of the social doctrine of the Church states that the principles are the dignity of the human person, the common good, subsidiarity, going to the smallest possible group to make something work, and solidarity. He did all of those. He recognised all of those in all his work. While he agreed with the urgent need for reform and assistance for the poor and for all society, he argued that humanism without God was devoid of the depth of the gospel. With his insight and his own theological anthropology, he named his society after St. Vincent de Paul, not naming the association after himself, but after the great pastoral French bishop of the 17th century, who was his inspiration and his patron. At the age of 20, he began his work of bringing the love of God in very concrete and practical ways to the dispossessed of Paris. This was not simply social reform. It, for him, was a way of making the face of Christ present to those in dire need. He wrote in a letter, we must fall at their feet and say to them, like the apostle, Tuas Dominus Manus, you are our masters and we are your servants. You are for us the sacred images of the God whom we do not see, and not knowing how to love him in any other way, we love him in you. Powerful stuff. He continued in his role at the same time as a teacher, as a married man, as a father, and a mentor to many young people around Paris and the rest of France. By the 1850s, there were over 2,000 branches of the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. This was new evangelization. Well before we had a word for it, he was evangelizing.
One of his students said, "I didn't ever understand what Christianity was till I met you." I think that's what Pope Francis is calling us to. And the Pope Frederick Osman was beatified by Pope John Paul II at World Youth Day in Paris in 1997, which itself is a great example of a new evangelization for so many Catholics. Going out with that passion of the missionary to the young and to the old, the many of the old have been brought back to the church by World Youth Day as well. And it has proved to be a healing presence in countries like Germany and a remarkable sign even in secular and cynical Sydney. Everyone predicted it to be a disaster. No police were called out. People said, "Who are those young people?" Now, how long it's lasted, but many vocations have come out of these encounters for wisdom. Pope John Paul says of Frederick Osman, he observed the real situation of the poor, reality, the reality check of mercy. He sought to be more and more effective in helping them in their human development. He understood that charity must lead to efforts to remedy injustice, so not separating mercy and justice, but bringing them together. Charity, he says, and justice go together. He had the clear-sighted courage to seek a frontline social and political commitment in a troubled time in the life of his country, for no society can accept indigence as if it were a simple fatality without damaging its honour. So it is that we can see in him a precursor of the social doctrine of the Church, which Pope Leo III would develop some years later in the encyclical Rerum Novarum. Frederick Osman spent his whole life on this project, on this St. Vincent de Paul, which is still with us today. Although sometimes we just take the saint out of it and make it Vinny's, which annoys me a little bit, because in fact it was the holiness of Frederick Osman that really makes this a movement unlike a simple social. Now, many good people are drawn into Vinny's, and there's a funny learning cartoon of a man meeting a man in heaven with a coat hanger on his head instead of a halo, and he says, "Ah, St. Vincent de Paul, I presume," which is quite funny. But the point is that it was this encounter with God, seeing the need of mercy in very tangible ways and understanding it from a theological perspective that drove Frederick Osman. And it's well worth reading his letters because he's ahead of his time, he's prophetic. And I think that's the final point about new evangelization. It is prophetic. It calls people to see God's mercy, to touch it, to encounter it. And he did this in a tireless way. Towards the end of his life, well, terribly long life, he travelled to where he was born, in Milan. But he was so exhausted that his wife Amélie and his daughter Marie compelled him to return to Marseille. And in 1853, his health deteriorated still further. On September the 8th, the Feast of the Nativity of the Virgin Mary, Frederick Osman committed his soul to God, saying, "My Lord, have mercy." Now, an interesting thing, you can't see it because it hasn't shown up on my slides, but over his tomb is a mosaic of the Good Samaritan, because he saw his inspiration was this parable of the Good Samaritan, that the Good Samaritan will pour the oil of God's mercy onto the wounded. So that became his kind of motivating evangelization of mercy. So we don't have to go too far, really, too far back in time to see a saint, Mother Teresa. There are many of our saints of our time, the saints of mercy. So I think that, you know, even reading those or being each one of those saints in turn was inspired by a saint of mercy. It's very interesting. Dorothy Day read St. Therese. Frederick Osman read St. Vincent de Paul. It's as if there's a family tree of mercy being passed down through the church. And I think that's true. We don't do it alone. We're in the communion of saints. So we don't pursue mercy as our own individualistic project. I'll leave it there and see if anyone's got questions. I hope that was of some interest to you. Thank you.
That was Anna Crone with Mercy and the New Evangelization. This talk was part of the Jubilee Year of Mercy series entitled Mercy, Love's Second Name, presented by the John Paul II Institute for Marriage and Family in Melbourne, Australia. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.